Good morning.
Hi.
Merry Christmas. You had a wonderful Christmas with family. Christmas isn't always easy, though. I know we used to, when I was a director of hospice, our busiest time was actually around the holidays, because it brings up a lot of expectations that sometimes aren't met. Last week I started talking about Dogen's fascicle, his Dharma talk on time being, but somehow when I was thinking about today, I wanted to not talk about time. It seemed a little too abstract. I wanted to talk about generosity, you know, Christmas and giving and opening the heart. I thought maybe I'll make that a tradition. I'll talk about, give a metta, talk on metta around Christmas time. Seems appropriate. And I was reflecting, but we'll pick up time being maybe next week or the week after. We'll come back to Dogen's fascicle on time and being, how our being can be thought about as time. So Buddha, you know, the story is that Buddha was enlightened. He spent many years preparing himself, and then it was as the morning star appeared in the sky, he had an opening. He gained some deep insight into the nature of reality. I think about that experience that he had, that actually we all have. Is available to us, where things all come together, that the dualities merge and all is right with the world. We just have that sense of peace and openness and just warm-heartedness and appreciation. We wish that feeling was bestowed upon us all the time, but we prepare the field in our meditation and spiritual practice, so hopefully those moments will visit us. So he looked up, as many of us do, and he was inspired by sort of the incredibleness of the evening sky, and somehow his small self receded and merged with everything. And I was thinking around Christmas that, you know, 400 years later, the wise men, you know, and I remember the tradition, they're all kind of dressed up and, you know, it's like Arabs or someplace from the East, right? But they were, who were they? You know, they were somebody seeking wisdom and truth, bodhisattvas on the path, seeking some deep understanding, and they too were guided by an evening star as they looked up in the sky, and they knew that there was something greater than just their small self that they could take refuge in. I think today, maybe at the end, we'll chant the Metta Sutra and dedicate it. We have a little dedication called the well-being ceremony. It's for everybody we know that could use some help. You know, maybe they're going through some sickness or tribulation. And as I mentioned, my good Dharma brother, Steve Stuckey, the abbot of Zen Center, is dying. He could well die this week, and I have been asked there to be there with him. So we'll send it out to him, but then to everybody that we know that could use some help, our warm, kind-heartedness. Of course, everybody could use that. And I'm maybe one of the sutras we'll chant is to the perfection of wisdom, to honoring prajna, that state of mind that, you know, was engendered when Buddha looked up into the heavens and saw the evening star. And the phrase, remember, it says, and we'll chant it this morning, to dispel the gloom and darkness of delusion. To dispel the gloom and darkness of delusion. You know, the delusion of separateness, delusion of our own narrow point of view. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about metta today, because metta practice, you know, usually our practice is just to be present, unconditionally present. And sometimes we miss the fact that this unconditioned present that we cultivate in our meditation practice of just being with whatever arises, even though it's difficult and unpleasant, that actually is practicing metta. It's practicing love, you know, just warm-hearted acceptance of what arises, of what we find ourselves in, whatever situation we find ourselves in. So in one of the chants in the Fukan Zazengi, Dogen's instruction about meditation, he says, we have this ability to just be unconditionally present with things, to really embrace reality. In our meditation practice, that is a definition for our meditation practice. We embrace reality, we embrace what is, and that we are enlightened as we do that, moment by moment. It's not something in the future, this great concept of our practice. And then he says, but if the least like or dislike arises, we're lost in confusion. You know, so it means that, what he means is, we have that ability to be present, but then as we begin to contract around our likes and dislikes, we lose ourselves in delusion. We lose ourselves in our small perspective. So our practice, our just being present, breath after breath, opens us up. We commit ourselves to that. But there is a practice that I didn't actually learn until maybe really start doing until maybe 15 years into serious practice, and that was metta practice, where we actually do a affirmation of that, a verbal affirmation of that. So we move a little more into the cognitive. And we say, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be free of suffering. You know, we basically take the four Brahma Viharas of love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and even-mindedness, and we articulate them in a phrase. And as I said, some of you have been doing this practice for many years, some have never, this is the first time you've heard of this practice. And sometimes I give, you know, a day retreat, or you can do week retreats on this. So I'm just going to introduce the concept to you a little bit. So you take a phrase and you begin to work the phrase. And you can make your own phrase. You know, if you want to just say, may I be patient, or may I be filled with generosity, or may I have kindness, find a phrase that works for you. But the traditional ones are, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be free of suffering. You start with yourself, and you begin to work the phrase. And as you do that, you'll find several things. One thing you'll find is that as you say the phrase, it's a mantra, that it will begin to still the discursive quality of your mind, that mind that's, you know, processing what you're going to be doing in 2 hours, or did when you got up this morning. It'll begin to still that, as a mantra will do. The second thing it'll do, it'll make you more aware of the quality of your state of mind. So as you're saying, may I be happy, and a thought's coming through that's going to make you unhappy, you actually become more aware of that. That thought is going to make me unhappy if I continue this thought. This thought will continue to engender suffering if I persist in turning this thought, you know, which is usually, I like this or I don't like that. So you're more aware of the thoughts, but also it just begins to create a deep intention that you want to be happy, that you want to be free of suffering, that you want to have your heart open. What metta practice means, what the word metta means, actually a little confusing for us because we wrap that phrase up into more our traditional way of thinking about love, which is much more kind of self-centered. You know, some warm passion, you know, some heat that requires some quid pro quo. You know, I'll give you some heat and passion if I get some heat and passion back, you know. But that's not what this, that's not what metta means. Metta means a spirit of warm-hearted generosity, a sense of kindness of the heart, a sense of goodwill, friendliness, generosity of the heart. I actually, one of the teachers that taught me meditation practice, Joseph Goldstein, when I did some studying with him, and he had an interesting way to phrase this where it seems less idealistic and more approachable in our everyday life. His quote was, "How can we hold strong differences of view in a larger context of unity beyond discord and hostility?" So I think we all can relate to that, right? It isn't like we have to be in this kind of pure state of love all the time, that actually discord and strong disagreement comes into our lives frequently. But how can we begin to phrase them and hold them in a bigger context? You know, I thought, I think, you know, isn't the Congress, don't they, doesn't some minister get up there and give some opening prayer to Congress when it starts? And I thought maybe they should give the meta phrase, you know, maybe they should read this sentence to Congress. How do we hold, okay, we're going to have strong differences, right? How do we hold strong differences of view in a larger context of unity beyond discourse and hostility? How do we create that intention? Not the intention that we're going to win and you're going to lose. But how do we create, how do we work, how do we dance together and navigate the realities of our lives in this context? So a couple of things that distinguish metta practice. One thing that distinguishes metta practice is that it's unequivocal. It doesn't mean that you want something in return. And if we're really honest, we realize how difficult this practice is, because usually when we give acts of kindness or generosity, there's a little part of us that wants reciprocity, if we're really honest. So this is asking us to move, to try to move beyond that, more a sense of how we relate maybe to children, you know, just a sense of giving, not wanting anything back, not wanting, there's not a quid pro quo involved in it. And the second thing that distinguishes metta from our usual idea of kind of love or desire is that it makes no distinction between beings. It extends to everyone. And that's why when we do metta practice, we start with ourselves, which is actually often the most difficult. We start with ourselves, and then we begin to extend out to people that we love, and then to or people that are, the next one is usually our benefactor, somebody that we have some that has done something really good for us, that we just immediately have good feelings about, right? And as I was taught this very pragmatically, a lot of people do it for their pets because we have unequivocally just good, warm feelings, or children or grandchildren. And then or it could be a teacher, you know, or somebody who was very kind to us, grandparent, you know. Then we extend out to more immediate family, and then we extend out to neutral people. And then eventually we extend out advanced practice into people we have a little bit of difficulty with, which can also be often our spouses. Sometimes they're further out, you know. And then we extend to people that we increasingly have more difficulty with. But we only move out as we feel our heart is ready to move out. We don't challenge, the idea is the practice is easy. We don't challenge ourselves with too much difficulty. You really want to create a sense of warm-hearted goodness. Traditionally, we start with ourselves, but actually often my experience has been over the years that people have a great deal of difficulty. And what you will experience, and I am telling you this, if you haven't already experienced it, I mean you will if you do, is there's a great deal of often self-loathing and a feeling that you're not worthy of it, you know. And so those feelings will come up. And so the idea is to soften into those feelings, you know, to soften into those feelings and to begin to make friends with all of your states of mind, even those states of your mind that tend to be critical of yourself, which we all have, right? It's maybe one of the main things that we work with. So we begin to see the resistance. It brings up resistance. So when we do the practice, we don't automatically fall into a pool of goodwill for ourselves. As it was taught to me, every time you say the phrase, you're planting the seed of intention. And the nature of karma is such that that seed will blossom. If you plant, every time you say something negative about yourself, you are planting a seed of negativity, you know. And every time you plant a seed of good intention for yourself or for another, it will karmically blossom at some point. We don't know when it will blossom, but it will. So again, the practice is find a phrase and just start to repeat it. Start with yourself. If that's too hard, you could start with a benefactor and then come back. The way I do the practice is I'll usually pick one phrase. I'll say, may I be peaceful. And I really try to create a sense of in my mind and body of peace. And then I may say that two or three times. And then I'll breathe for two or three times. I'll just go into my regular practice of breathing and not thinking about it, just creating that space, and maybe I'll come back to the same phrase or I'll come back to another phrase. May I be happy. What would happy feel like in my body and my mind? And if you remember last year, occasionally I go back and I review one of the very first discourses the Buddha gave on meditation, the Satipatthana Sutra. And I always am impressed at how this metta practice, which we think is kind of a later development, is actually embedded in that first sutra, where he's saying, as I breathe in, I calm my body and my mind. As I breathe in, I bring joy to my body and mind. So in that very first sutra that Buddha was teaching about meditation, he's actually laying the foundation and groundwork for this more developed metta practice. This practice can be done in your formal practice like today. It could be done at the beginning of your meditation. Usually I'll often do it at the end of my meditation for about 5 minutes. You know, but you can also do it when you're driving. You can do it in the supermarket. You can do it walking down the street. Just dispensing little blessings as you go. May you be happy. Just as you're walking by, maybe you're not going to give money to somebody that's asking for it, but you can give them a blessing. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be at ease. And as you begin to create that field, it has a tremendous effect. So when you're with people like the Dalai Lama, you know, Mother Teresa, these people that have been cultivating this as a practice their whole life, you palpably feel that. You feel the healing quality of that. And you know that when you're in the presence of somebody that can do that. So we don't expect an immediate shift, but we have patience. And we know that by the law of karma that it will bear fruit. Let me say something about the importance, which many people, it's a more advanced practice, but you get doing it for yourself, you kind of get doing it for somebody that's difficult. One practice that's hard for people is to do it for a neutral person. And I'd very much encourage you to do it for a neutral person. Just pick somebody that's neutral in your life. Like maybe somebody at the check stand, you know, at the grocery store that you go through and you say hi to, just somebody that's kind of more neutral. Don't have positive feelings or negative feelings. And just start to do it for them. And it'll take you a while. It may be a week or 2 weeks. Every day, begin to do it for that person. And you'll begin to notice that your feeling to that person will start to warm. What I've noticed is that I become more interested in that person. I bring them more into my consciousness. I have more care, more concern for them. The other thing that's very important in this practice is you begin to notice that how you feel about somebody. This is such a pivotal point in our practice. How you feel about somebody is less dependent on how they treat you and how they feel about you than how you feel about them. So that's a huge step in our practice when we begin to see that what this practice is about is taking responsibility for our own state of mind. And the example that I read again and again in many places is the example of this doctor that was a Tibetan doctor for the Dalai Lama, and he was imprisoned by the Chinese, and it was tortured for many years, 20 years, you know. And he would do metta practice for his captors. And what he said was one of the most difficult things. He realized that what he was afraid is that his state of mind would become like his captors. If he began to hate them, his state of mind would be like them. And so he began to take this on, this experience he was having of being imprisoned and tortured, as a way to cultivate deeper metta for not only himself and his suffering, but also for his captors and for all beings. And he was actually able to do that in the most trying of circumstances. So a tremendously encouraging example of how that works. So I'd like to give you a couple of hints about how to do metta that will encourage and help you. And I have a disclosure for you. When I was first learning this practice, I was reading, and Jack Kornfield was giving an example of how he was going to give a talk on metta. And he got in an argument with his girlfriend right before he had to go out and do the metta talk, you know. So he had to go give the talk when he just finished having an argument. And I've always thought, I've had a bemused attitude towards this story, and it actually happened to me this morning.
Oh, no.
I'm sitting at the table, I'm writing this metta, I'm actually in a really good place. I'm thinking, this is real, this is wonderful, I'm so happy, I love to talk about this topic, right? And I'm in the state of mind, and Chris comes in, and she's up a little later than me this morning. She comes in, and she gets a text from our son, who's in Mexico. And he's saying things are great, and everything's happy. And I have a kind of negative, I don't want to get into it, because you'll probably take her point of view. But I had a point of view about how often we should be texting our son, you know. Give him a little break, you know. And we got into this immediate argument. And, you know, as the usual thing, I had a point of view. She had a point of view. We couldn't see each other's point of view. We both coalesced behind our point of view. Does that sound familiar? Huh? Doesn't it? And so I had to work with it, you know. And so as I worked with it, I was going through. I started to actually do the phrases. And I found almost immediate relief. I usually do. I guess it's almost impossible to say the phrases and still lock down behind your self-righteousness and your right. And of course, there is a part of you that's right, you know, that your perspective has truth to it, right? But as you say the phrases, you begin to see that there's more. So here are the four things that will help you besides just doing the phrases. The phrases, all these are included in the phrases. The first one is that whatever difficulty you're in, whatever contraction you're in, you begin to see that situation, difficult situation, where somebody's not seeing your point of view, or is really actually hurting you, you begin to see it in a bigger context. Like the doctor, the Tibetan physician that was in prison for 20 years, you reframe it in a different context. And of course, all when we're studying the 59 aphorisms in the Lojong teachings, all of these address that, especially point 3 of mind training, which is take all difficulties and incorporate them into the path. So the more you develop in your spiritual practice, the more you're able to call that to mind. How do I see this as an opportunity to broaden my perspective, either to cultivate patience, to cultivate a skillful way to communicate, whatever it is, it's calling on you to frame it in a bigger context other than just your own pain. Not easy. I'm not saying these things are easy. The second one is you begin to see that all people want to be free of suffering. No matter how deluded they are, you know, no matter how unskillful the way that they are trying to address their lives, they are trying to be free of suffering, whether it's through their addiction or whatever. Everybody's trying to be happy in their own way. And you also deeply understand the laws of karma. And this is a little bit tricky. You trust that as you act in the world, the result will come to you. And that's not always obvious. You know, you see people that seem to be the bask in the fruits of what our culture says is success. Recognition, success, money, wealth, power. But really, the deeper you look, you see again and again where happiness really lies. And it never lies with being cruel and mean. It never lies that way and being selfish. And so you know the rules of karma. So it's not like in your mind you're saying, you're going to get yours. You're going to get your comeuppance. That's not what that's not how you use karma. The way you use it is that you know that there's suffering and that you actually can bring some kind-hearted, generous feeling to people even that are hurting you because you know deep down they're suffering. So that's a deep practice. That's not an easy practice. But you try to cultivate that. And the third practice is that you try to let go of a sense of pride and self-importance. What I say to people, you know, I do mediation work and work with couples, and what I often say to people, if they can hear it, is the more self-righteous you feel about your point of view, the more you're stuck. There's something about you that's stuck. So that, of course, brings you back to the first point of view, which is there's something here for you to learn in this situation. And what that doctor said when they were, how did you get through these 20 years? Besides the first point, he said, I had to let go of my kind of self-righteousness. I had to let go of my sense of self-importance. You know, and there was something about that that really enabled him to sink down into a more tender part in his heart. You know, one of the definitions of bodhicitta, or cultivating the heart of enlightenment, is to feel the tenderness of your heart for other people, and to be able to feel your own pain and suffering, and be able to feel it in a way where you don't lose yourself in it, but it tenderizes you. You know, that's where metta practice and compassion practice come together. So maybe maybe there'll be some suggestions there. I encourage you to do metta practice. Just pick one of those phrases, make your own, incorporate it into your life. Do it not only on your cushion, but do it as you're driving, as you're walking. Do it every day. You know, just send out little blessings to yourself and to the universe, because the law of karma is such that it will come back to you.